that. We are ready on the second.
Yeah. Okay. So we had left off on the second essay. It's Maimer Sheni, paragraph Zion, the seventh paragraph, which Sif Zion. Sif Zion. Yeah, Sif Zion. And in the books, in the these books, it's page 153.
Yes.
Right. So, the discussion. Yeah.
This is handwritten sailing. Here on the bottom, 153.
Yeah. The discussion was up to date, just to get it, you know, it's been 2 weeks, so we just have to remind ourselves what happened. But basically, the Chaver has been explaining, the Rav has been explaining to the king of the Kesars, that all of the terms in the Tanakh that are used to describe God that are somewhat human in nature, you know, don't really mean that. It's all just the human way of understanding and relating, you know, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And, you know, there were some things in there which were a little bit surprising, even things like, you know, God being compassionate, God being merciful, you know, says the Kuzari have to be understood, you know, this is what we use as human beings to describe God, but Be'emes, you know, in truth, we really don't even understand what those things mean when applied to the Ribbono Shel Olam.
In this week's portion,
Ki chanun ani.
Right.
Ki chanun ani.
Right. So in other words, what that means is I act in a way if I were a human being, you would call me chanun. But, you know, that's the way the Kuzari explains.
But it's sort of nice to think of God as compassionate. It takes something away from the whole thing. Right. Next time I ask for his compassion, I will wonder, you know, how could that... It's better the other way.
Right, no, so that's exactly the reason that the Torah describes him in such terms.
So meaning that we could understand
it's not wrong. In other words, it's not that we call God compassionate, but really Chalila, he's cruel. You know, he acts in a way
he acts in a way in which we
understand that as being compassionate. But again, compassion really is a human type of trait. Whatever that thing is that God has that ends up being compassionate vis-a-vis us is something that's really beyond our understanding. Okay, so we have no other way to call it, so we call it compassionate. It's not that it's wrong, it's just that it's, you know, it's describing God according to our limitations.
Yeah, like, Rofei Cholei Am Yisrael.
Right. So
same thing.
He's not quite a healer in the human sense of the term.
We beg him, he should heal us, he should help us with our pains. And
all this time we've been studying what God is not.
Right.
Now,
what
is
God? Is?
That's right.
That's the next book. the one that no human being is capable of writing.
It's not written yet.
Right.
So how do humans who are plain basar adam relate to a God who's so far away from us?
These terms. And, you know, in other words, these terms are not accurate, but they're the best we can do because we have to relate. In other words, you're right. If we didn't want to relate, if we didn't think it was important to relate, so we wouldn't use any terms at all. You know, we can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I think, that's it. But, you know, precisely because it's important for us to relate, even though we really, really can't, you know.
Humans,
I mean,
we have to relate.
Right, as humans we need to do something. So this is the best we can do as humans to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
It's not that we're not supposed to relate like this. We do, because
that's the only way we can. Right. You know, to really understand, we're not going to understand, but to the extent to which we can put any words on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, these are words which are inadequate. They don't really express what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all about, but they're the best we have, and we should use them. I mean, we see the Torah itself uses them, because, you know, the alternative is just not to have a relationship at all, and that certainly is not something that the Torah wants. So it's walking a fine line. In other words, we have this relationship, we want to have this relationship, but we understand that we're not really going to understand. You know, there isn't any second book, any sequel, where what God really is described. I mean, that's what Moshe Rabbeinu has to Ribbono Shel Olam. You know, Hareini Nos Kvodecha, you know, show me what you're all about. I want to read that second book. And Hashem says, Ki lo yirani ha'adam v'choy, not just that you can't see me, but you're not really going to understand me. There's nothing I can do to adequately express to you what it is that I'm all about, you know, that you can really understand me. So it says that the king of the Kesars buys all of this. So Omar HaKuzari, in the beginning of 7 of Zion, Kvar hisparli sod hamidos, So now I understand this whole secret that was very hard for me to understand about the midos, the attributes of God. But it's galgali havonis inyan Hashem, u'malachus Hashem, u'shchina. I even understand, you know, all these concepts such as the glory of God and the angels of God and the concept of the Shechina, right? In other words, these are terms that describe the feeling we have when we feel like we're in the presence of God, right? As he described, Vayered Hashem al Har Sinai, that God came down in Har Sinai. So that doesn't mean that God literally came down, because again, as God, he doesn't go up, he doesn't go down. But as we felt his presence at Har Sinai, that was the Kvod Hashem. V'shehem shemos noflum advar nirim eitzel ha-neviim, that these things are all things which the Neviim perceive. Kamo she'omar amud anan eishocheles av arofel eish noga. We have all these terms that talk about the cloud of God, the fire of God, the splendor of God. And all of these things describe things which Neviim see, but we're incapable of seeing. So Lamashal, he says, Kasher nomar al ha'or baboker v'erev av yom ha'ma'unon, ki ha'or nitzotz min ha'shemesh. So for instance, we say that when we see the light, you know, coming through, even on a cloudy day, we say that the light is coming from the sun. Afal pi shehi nisteres, and that's true even when the sun is hidden. V'nomar she'ha'or v'anitzotz me'etzem ha'shemesh v'ein okein. We describe the light coming from the sun, even though, in a sense, it's not really the light of the sun, because we don't see the sun itself, but we see this light, we perceive that in some indirect fashion it comes from the sun. So, achagufos hanifalos benochacham v'ye'oru bohem, right, the sun's light bounces off the various objects which it hits and is reflected by those objects. So in point of fact, we're not really seeing the light of the sun, we're seeing light that comes from the sun, which is reflected off others. So too, we can never really perceive God himself, right? The same way you can't look directly at the sun. All we can see is the light that bounces off other things, i.e. the perception we have of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his involvement in the world, right? So Amar HaChaver, so that was pretty good. I mean, the king of the case is caught on pretty quickly. Amar HaChaver, yeah, King HaKavod, Nitzos Or Eloki Moel Eitzel Amo Uva Artso. You're right, you got it exactly right. When we talk about Kavod Hashem, the glory of God, that means a shaft of light that comes, so to speak, a shaft of divine light that enables man to appreciate God a little bit more if the person in question is a member of God's nation and is located in God's land. Right?
But if you're not in the country.
Right, if you're not in the country, we'll see. Doesn't
work. Not right? The same level.
So Amar HaKuzari, so says the Kuzari, the king of the cases, Ma'amar Ha'etzel Amo Kvar Yisporeli. I understand that you're telling me that God's nation has a special ability to perceive God that other people lack. I mean, that was the whole thing that the king of the Caesars originally didn't like, and the Chaver stuck to his guns about how the Jewish people have this genetic tendency to be able to perceive God, to see God in the world around us. We have this genetic tendency towards godliness. Alright, so you convinced me of that already, that the Jewish people as a nation are special. I got it. But you're telling me about some special godly country? That God has a country? God has a country which is more God's country than all the other countries in the world? What's the story with that? This is a new one you're springing on me. You know, it took me so long to appreciate the idea that God has a people. And now you're telling me God has a country? How does that work? Omer Achover. And here we mentioned last time that this is going to begin a long discussion about the uniqueness, the special quality of Eretz Yisrael, which for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi was a topic that was close to his heart. You know, as we mentioned, you know, the author of the Kinnas that talk about Eretz Yisrael, the man who in old age traveled to Eretz Yisrael, you know, to be there, the man who wrote poetry about Eretz Yisrael, is a man who was suffused with love for Eretz Yisrael. And it comes here right in the beginning, right, the very first lessons that the Rav and the King of the Kesers are having together, the topic of Eretz Yisrael comes up. So, Omer Achover, Al Yikshe Be'inecho Shetisyachit Eretz B'dover Mikol Ho'aratzos. You should not be puzzled by the fact that there's one land which is special from all the other lands. You see, I mean, you see in your own experience that there's some places which are especially good for producing this kind of plant or this kind of thing that comes from the ground. Some animals prosper more in certain regions than others. And the truth is, you see that certain people, in, even in certain countries, you know, have certain tendencies and abilities which distinguish them from other people. I mean, people in a certain country, you know, tend to be, or a certain region tend to be very tall. People in another region tend to be very short. I mean, we see that there's, you know, things are divided up regionally. Over mitzua hamezeg, tia shleimus hanefesh v'chesrona. Right? The same way that a person's physical makeup can determine whether his spiritual qualities are going to be more complete or less complete, right? So, you know, you can appreciate that certain places are particularly suited for certain kinds of things, certain plant life, certain mineral life, certain animal life. So why can't you appreciate that certain countries are more particularly suited for certain types of spiritual life? So Amar Akuzari, so says the king of the Kaisers, that's all fine and good, but and any shomea im ashochnim be'eretz Yisrael Yisram al shar anshei ha'olam. I know people who live in Eretz Yisrael. They don't seem to be to me to be much better than anybody else in the rest of the world, right? So Omer Achover, kein hareches hazeh sha'atem omrim shematzliach bo hakerem ilu lo hayonotin bo hakfanim va'ovdim ha'adama haruya lohem lo hayo osa anovim. You know what the mashal is? You want to understand why there's some people in Eretz Yisrael who just, you know, don't seem to be particularly extraordinary vis-a-vis the rest of the people in the world? You know, Mr. King, Your Honor, I see that there's a certain mountain range where you produce excellent vines and excellent grapes. So you'll tell me that that particular area is particularly suited for producing grapes. Okay, great. I understand that. So let me ask you the following. Let's say you never planted the vines, you never planted the vineyard in that area, and you just walk over to that area and you say, okay, this is a wonderful place for producing wine. How come I don't see any grapes? Right? Obviously, the fact that the soil is particularly suited for producing grapes is just step one. You know, then you have to actually plant the vines, then you have to cultivate the vines, then you have to, you know, actually grow the grapes, then you have to press the grapes into wine. The suitability of the area is just the first thing, it's the prerequisite. So similarly, there could be tons of people living in Eretz Yisrael who are in a climate which is suited for Ruchnius, but it's not automatic. You know, you move to Eretz Yisrael and boom, you know, now you're ready to become an automatically spiritual person. You still have to do a lot of planting and cultivating.
It's the potential.
Right, the potential is there, but you know, to bring the potential to the actual is still a lot of work. V'amaylam yucheres harishona hil'om she'skul ovolev kasher zocharti. The land's special qualities, first of all, have to be applied to a nation that has these special qualities. So, you know, so right off the bat, he says the fact that you have non-Jews living in Eretz Yisrael isn't necessarily going to do anything for them, right? And it's a combination. Now, you know, I can take the most wonderful soil in the world, but if I plant, a type of plant which is not suited for that particular soil, it's not going to grow. So too, I can have non-Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael. It's nothing automatic about Eretz Yisrael which is going to give them this heightened degree of spirituality, right? V'yesh la'aretz ezer bozer. All that the land does is it helps develop these spiritual qualities. Im ha'maisim v'ataros ha'tluyos bo asherhem ka'avodo la'kerem. Together with the special mitzvahs which are connected to Eretz Yisrael, which are the equivalent of the various actions that I have to do in order to cultivate the vineyard. I plant the vineyard in the soil and then I have to cultivate it. How do I cultivate the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael? So the mitzvahs that especially the mitzvahs hatliyos ba'arav, you know, the mitzvahs that are dependent on the land, are the ways to bring out the spirituality of the people living in the land of Israel. Avolo yitochein laskula hazos lagia el ha'inyan ha'eloki bibalade hamakom hazeh. But you should know that even the Jewish people, with all of their milus, all of their positive attributes, they can never achieve the inyan ha'eloki. They can never really come close in the ultimate sense to godliness, by which, by the way, he's going to tell us he means nevuah, he means prophecy. So in other words, you could be a frum Jew outside of Eretz Yisrael, but if you were signing up for a course, if the you know, if the local shuls here offered courses in nevuah, right, it would be you would probably you know, ask for a refund after a little while, because to get nevuah outside of Eretz Yisrael is basically not going to happen. For nevuah to happen, you know, the highest encounter of a human being with the Ribbono Shel Olam, you have to have the Jewish people together with Eretz Yisrael, and then we can start to talk. You know, then the ingredients are in place for the ultimate encounter between human beings and God. Just as this mountain range is so special, you know, he points to this mountain range upon which the king has planted these incredible vineyards, you know, that produce grapes. This mountain is very special, and the kind of grapes that you want, these super duper grapes, are only going to be able to be produced on this mountain range. You know, the nevuah can only come from Eretz Yisrael. So Amar Akuzari, so Yud Gimel asked the king of the Kesers, Veichu's that? What are you talking about? Prophecy only comes in Eretz Yisrael. Ukvar nibu me Adam harishon v'ad Moshe be'eretz acheres. From Adam to Moshe, people prophesied in different lands. Adam harishon had his encounter with God in Gan Eden, right? Now, the pashut of pshat of the psukim, the simple reading of the psukim, where's Gan Eden? Right? Well, the simple pshat of psukim doesn't sound like that, right? Which is what the king of the cases is working with, right? The simple pshat in the psukim makes it sound like Gan Eden is somewhere in Iraq. You say, why is Gan Eden in Iraq? Well, because the pasuk tells us, "V'nahar yotze me'Eden lahashkos es hagan." There was a river that came out of Eden in order to, you know, to water the garden. U'misham yipare v'hayo l'arba roshim. And somewhere, it sounds like somewhere around Gan Eden, the river split into four different rivers, and it goes on to name them. And two of the rivers are the Tigris and the Euphrates. Right, one of them is the Chidekel, which is the Tigris, and the Pros, which is usually translated as the Euphrates River. Okay, so you do a little bit of geography. My 11-year-old daughter told me this morning, she came to the, had a lecture this morning here in the shul, Rabbi Yehuda Landy from Eretz Yisrael spoke about the background of the Persian Empire. So he starts out with a big map. So my 11-year-old daughter was there, so she came up to me afterwards and said, yeah, it was so strange. He started talking about the Tigris and the Euphrates, and I thought that was only stuff that you learned in history class in sixth grade. I didn't think it was real, you know, Tigris. So I told her, you know, it's in Chumash, the Chidekel and the Pros, you know, it's right there. So again, I mean, just, if you think about what the Pasuk seems to be saying, the Pasuk is locating Gan Eden somewhere around, it sounds like, somewhere around the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, which would put it smack in the middle of Iraq. Right, Mesopotamia. Right, so Adam Arishon, Gan Eden. I mean, nowadays people usually don't use the terms Gan Eden and Iraq in the same sentence, you know. But right, you know. But you know, the simple reading of the Psukim and Bereishis sounds like that's where Gan Eden is. So that seems to be what the King of the Kesers is assuming. Gan Eden is in Iraq, so that means the Maisa with Adam in Gan Eden is in Iraq. So if he's outside of Eretz Yisrael and he's talking to God, you see, you can talk to God outside of Eretz Yisrael, right?
Moshe Rabbeinu never got to Eretz Yisrael.
Right, never got to Eretz Yisrael. Right. I mean, and what's the first time that he encounters the Ribbono Shel Olam? Right, by the Sneh, which is somewhere in Midian. Right, because he was working in Midian, watching the sheep of Yisro. Mm-hmm. So the burning bush is in Midian. So God comes to Moshe Rabbeinu in Midian. Right? And Har Sinai, the ultimate revelation, is totally outside of Eretz Yisro. Right? There's a very famous
country. Until Israel was chosen to be the chosen country, all the other countries were kosher. Considered an ahai madrega.
Right, so you could say like that. I think the king of the Kuzari, however, you know, the Chavir is going to have two problems with that. So number one, Eretz Yisrael seems to have been chosen at least from the time of Avraham Avinu. Right, because after all, El Aretz Sharayaka and Brisman Absarim and all this kind of stuff, right? So in other words, it's the Eretz Hanivcheres, you know, the chosen land from the time of Avraham Avinu. Plus, especially from Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's perspective, it goes back even further than that, because the same way he sees the Jewish people as possessing something genetic, Eretz Yisrael is not just special, you know, almost arbitrarily because God chose it. Eretz Yisrael is somehow, there's something fundamental in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, again, how you measure it, I don't know. But the same way that there are certain places that naturally, you know, produce oranges or produce grapefruits or whatnot, so Eretz Yisrael, from the time that God created the world, produces Nevuah. You know, it's not that it was chosen later on, it's that from the beginning of time, as he's going to develop, you know, this was considered to be a special land. Right, so you know that, and that's what the Chavir is trying to say, and that's why the King of the Kesis is pushing back and say, well, what about Adam Arishon? What about Moshe Rabbeinu? What about Avram Be'ur Kasdim? I mean, Avram gets the first Nevuah is Lech Lecha Me'Arzecha. Well, so by definition, he wasn't in Eretz Yisrael, right? Because Lech Lecha had to come before Eretz Yisrael. V'achakach Yecheskel v'Daniel beBavel, and Yecheskel and Daniel prophesized in Bavel. The Yirmiyah in Mitzrayim, and Jeremiah and Yirmiyah prophesized later when he went with the Jews down to Mitzrayim after the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash. So what are you telling me that Nevuah
came out of Eretz Yisrael?
Oh, okay.
Originally,
okay. So he's going to take that idea and develop it. Uh-huh. By the way, you see, the King of the Khazars learns ganz fine. I mean, you know, I mean, right. I mean, you go, the truth is, I hate to say it, you go to the average yeshiva graduate and you ask them, okay, you know, name me six people who prophesized outside of Eretz Yisrael. I'm not sure that they would do as well. He has it on the tip of his tongue, you know. What are you talking about? I have a whole bunch of personalities who had Nevuah outside of Eretz Yisrael. Right? So Amar Achover. So says the Rav. Kol mi shehisnabei lo nisnabei ki imba o ba'avura. I'm going to tell you the following principle. Everyone you mentioned, I'll go through all the six, he says. Everyone you mentioned either prophesied in Eretz Yisrael or because of Eretz Yisrael, on behalf of Eretz Yisrael. Right? In other words, that's legitimate. In other words, I can prophesize outside of Eretz Yisrael if the prophecy somehow relates back to Eretz Yisrael. Oh, okay, so we'll see. Yeah. So let me go through it. Let's start with Avraham Avinu. That's the most obvious. God appears to Avraham Avinu in Ur Kasdim and he says, Lech Lecha Me'Arzecha. Go leave your land, go to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so the whole point of that Nevuah was to, you know, command him to go to Eretz Yisrael. So that's a legitimate form, or a legitimate connection between the prophecy and Eretz Yisrael, because it was geographically outside of Eretz Yisrael, but it was for the sake of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that's okay. Yecheskel v'Doniel miponeha. Yecheskel and Doniel both prophesize because of Eretz Yisrael, i.e., the nevuos of Yecheskel and Doniel all concern the ultimate restoration of the Jewish people to Eretz Yisrael. Right? Yecheskel in particular spends a lot of time prophesizing about the building of the third Beis Hamikdash. That's the last eight chapters of Yecheskel. Daniel foretells the all of history till the end of days and when Mashiach is going to come. So certainly that is all about the return to Eretz Yisrael. So again, it's not so different from Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was told, you know, to go to Eretz Yisrael. These Nevi'im are describing how we're all going to go back one day to Eretz Yisrael. That's number one. And number two, Kvar hayu nimtzoyim bebayis rishon, v'robu ashchina sher behimotza hayu magia l'nevuah kol amuchon lo me'askula. Point number two, with Doniel and Yecheskel specifically, is that they each started off in Eretz Yisrael. They had seen the Shechina in Eretz Yisrael. They both lived during the end of the period of the Bayis Rishon, and then they were exiled to Bavel. So, in other words, the pump was primed already, so to speak, by them having grown up in Eretz Yisrael. They had that connection. So when they went into Bavel, and because so many of their nevuos concerned the return to Eretz Yisrael, those two factors together allowed them to prophesize outside of Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Aval Adam, he haisa admasa. What you said about Adam Arishon, you know, and you assume that Gan Eden was in Iraq, it's not true. Gan Eden was in Eretz Yisrael, says the Chavre. Right? That was his land, Adam Arishon's land. Uva Meis, and he died in Eretz Yisrael. Kasher Kibalnu, because we have a tradition as such, because after all, Kibama Ara Arba Azugos, Adam V'Chava, Avraham V'Sara, Yitzchak V'Rivka, Yaakov V'Leah. Our tradition is, and now again, this is a rabbinic tradition, and one which is not explicit in the Chumash, right? But we have a rabbinic tradition that Ma'ara Samach Pelo contains not only the Avos and Imahos, but it contains the remains of Adam and Chava. Now that, you know, makes sense if Adam and Chava lived in Eretz Yisrael. Right? If they were living in Iraq, we would expect to find their tomb somewhere in Iraq. You know, so the fact that we have this tradition that they died, you know, in Eretz Yisrael and were buried in the Ma'ara Samach Pela implies that they lived in Eretz Yisrael as well. V'hi ha'aretz ha'nikres lifnei Hashem. This land is referred to as the land that's before God. Right? And we'll see why that's significant in understanding the story in Bereishis in just a minute. Ha'nemar aleha Tamid Eine Hashem Elokecha Ba, because the Pasuk in Devarim describes Eretz Yisrael as the land which God's eyes are perpetually focused on. So in other words, to be in Eretz Yisrael means to be Lifnei Hashem, to be in the presence of God. Lifnei Hashem, if a person is being described as being in the presence of God, it means that they're in Eretz Yisrael. That's what that term means, says the Kuzari. So listen to this. V'oleha nafla hakina v'achemda ben hevel v'kayin b'tchila. In fact, that's what Kayin and Hevel were fighting about when Kayin ultimately killed Hevel. Right? It wasn't just about whose carbon was going to be accepted. God's accepting the carbon of Hevel and rejecting the one of Kayin was the symptom of a larger dispute between the two of them, i.e., we're both living in Eretz Yisrael, who's going to inherit this special land? Now that idea, which Rabbi Yehuda Levi puts forward here, is taken from the Midrashim, right? So there is a there are different Midrashim that describe what they were arguing about, but one Midrash has it that Cain and Hevel were arguing about who was going to possess Eretz Yisrael. So that fits in like a glove into this whole thesis of Yehuda Levi. Because they were in Eretz Yisrael, and because they knew the value of Eretz Yisrael, naturally they would be fighting over it. Kisharatsu ladas, eisem em arotso, ilios bemakom adam skulaso velipo, lincholes haaretz, ilidavik beinyin haeloki, v'yi yezulaso kiklipo. Right? Why were they arguing over Eretz Yisrael bedavka? Because who's going to merit to possess Eretz Yisrael? You know, the one with the bigger army? No, the one who's going to merit Eretz Yisrael is the one who's chosen by God to have that special gene for godliness. Because the one who has the gene for godliness, the one who is the forerunner of the chosen people, is going to get the chosen land. The other one, who's not going to be from the chosen people, is not going to get the chosen land. So ultimately that person will lose Eretz Yisrael. So let's appreciate the story, the way Rabbi Yehuda Levi understands the story. They both bring karbonos. God listens to Hevel and accepts his karbon. He rejects the karbon of Kayin. Mm-hmm. So says Kayin, oh, you know what that shows? That shows that my brother has the gene and I don't. So that means that my brother is going to get Eretz Yisrael and I'm going to get kicked out. Right? All of this, you know, that's why there's so much at stake with the acceptance of the carbon of Hevel and the rejection of the carbon of Kayin. That's why Kayin is so angry. It's not just the carbon. It's everything. It's who's going to be chosen. It's who's going to get the chosen land. You know, it's everything. It's everything in the world up until that time. So Kayin gets so angry he kills Hevel. I guess he figures that by process of elimination, you know, if there's only one person left in the world, you know, so I've got to get Eretz Yisrael because there's no other choice. Ve'era ma she'era mehariga's hevel v'nishra hamalchus ariris. Right, so Hevel was killed, and the kingdom was left childless, so to speak. In other words, there was no one at this point who was now going to inherit the gene, because the gene, certainly Cain didn't have it, and Hevel's dead, so what's going to happen to this gene? What happens? So v'ne'emar v'yetze Cain melifnei Hashem. The pasuk, when describing how Cain goes into Golus, describes how Cain leaves from before God. He goes out from being in the presence of God. So again, says the Kuzari, says the Chaver. So what does that mean? What does it mean to be in the presence of God? It means, in the terminology of the Chumash, to be in Eretz Yisrael. So when Cain is kicked out and made to wander, what it means is God asks him to leave Eretz Yisrael. That's the pshat in the whole story. So in a sense, Cain is the first Golos. Right, the first Golos from Eretz Yisrael, says Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is Cain, because he sinned and he didn't appreciate the land of Israel that he was in. So God said, "You're leaving Eretz Yisrael." So you talk about Ma'aseh Avos Simul Habonim. I mean, you know, from the very beginning of humanity, the idea of being thrown out of Eretz Yisrael because of sin starts with Cain. Shi'asa Megarash Meha'aretz Hazos Shaba Hayu. He was wandering around the world, thrown out, milifnei Hashem, thrown out from Eretz Yisrael. Right? So in other words, just going back to the Adam HaRishon point, says the Rav, you told me Gan Eden was in Iraq. It's not true. Gan Eden was in Eretz Yisrael, as you can tell from the description of Cain being thrown out, milifnei Hashem. What does milifnei Hashem mean, if not from being thrown out from Eretz Yisrael? Aye, so what do you do with the pasuk we quoted earlier? Yeah. Right? You know, in other words, Venar Yotze Meyedem, Lahashko Sisagon. Right? Right? So, Lechara, the way you have to understand this, I don't think he addresses directly, but I think you have to understand as follows. The Gan Eden is an Eretz Yisrael. The Eden, right? The Gemara says that the Gan and Eden are two different places. In other words, Eden is this, you know, very, very spiritual place. The Gan is the garden, which is removed from Eden. The river goes from Eden to the Gan, and then it keeps flowing. Umisham yiparet, at some point after it keeps flowing, it separates into these four rivers. So in other words, the river goes through Gan Eden, which is in Eretz Yisrael, and then somehow continues on to Iraq, and then at that point it splits up into the four rivers. Now the pasuk never says directly that the four rivers are in the vicinity of Gan Eden. It just says that the river which, you know, irrigates Gan Eden ultimately flows probably underground, you know, and ends up being these four rivers. So, you know, the four rivers may appear off in Iraq, but that doesn't tell us that Gan Eden is necessarily in Iraq. Right? So, again, you know, that wouldn't have been the automatic way that someone would have read the Psukim, but, you know, we can understand why the King of the Kaisers assumes that Gan Eden is in Iraq. But again, says the Chaver, no. But, you know, since we know that Gan Eden is in Eretz Yisrael, and that's the whole point of Cain being in Eretz Yisrael and being removed from it, so Mimela, you know, there has to be something, some other way in which we reinterpret those psukim. V'chein emar b'yona. The same thing is true with Yonah. V'yakum Yonah livrach tashisha melifnei Hashem. When Yonah runs away, you know, when he runs away melifnei Hashem, from before God, i.e., he runs out of Eretz Yisrael. So, in other words, we see that term again. That lifnei Hashem means Eretz Yisrael. Lo barach ki im mimakom hanevuah. Right? He ran away from Eretz Yisrael because that's the place in which nevuah comes. Veheshiv osoho elokim eleha mimei hadaga v'niba ba. And what happened? God restored him. He brought him back to Eretz Yisrael from the depths of the fish, and that's where he had his nevuah.
But he had to go to Nineveh.
Oh, so
that's where he gave
his right. So in other words, it's not right. The way you assume when you read the psukim. But again, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is giving you what he considers to be pshat and pasuk. So we normally assume, right? So Yonah runs away from Eretz Yisrael, gets on the boat at Yafo. Mm-hmm. Right, and he goes off on the boat, he gets swallowed up by the fish coughs him up on dry land, where? Well, right. So I think when you read the story, you usually assume he coughs him up near Nineveh, mm-hmm. right? You know the it was a convenient fish, right? You know, it was a got a cheap fare, you know, going to Nineveh. He coughed him up near Nineveh, gets out of he wipes himself off, goes over to Nineveh, and he gives the nevuah, right? But says the Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, no, that's not the way it happened. He's inside the fish. The fish coughs him up in Eretz Yisrael. He gets the nevuah to go to Nineveh, and then he goes to Nineveh. And if you think about it, the geography agrees with Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, even though you might have thought otherwise, right? Where's Yafo? Yafo is Tel Aviv, right? Mm-hmm. So he goes to Yafo, right? And he sails off in a ship. Where? Which direction is he going? I mean, presumably west, right? Because if you think about the geography, it's the Mediterranean, right? I mean, when he gets onto the ship at Yafo, so the big body of water is the Mediterranean. I mean, you know, he can go west, he can go south, he can go north, but which way is Nineveh? Mm-hmm. Nineveh's east. Nineveh's in northern Iraq. It's in the kingdom of Assyria. Right? So if he's getting on a boat onto the Mediterranean, he's certainly not going to get coughed up in Nineveh because he's going in the wrong direction. Right? I mean, Nineveh, Nineveh is back in the area where the Tigris and Euphrates are. Right, he's going as far away from Nineveh as he possibly can, which, by the way, makes sense considering what he wants to do, because the last thing he wants to do in the world is go to Nineveh. Right, so he doesn't want to take a ship that's going to take him on the way to Nineveh. Right, he gets onto a ship that's going off into the Mediterranean. Nineveh's in the other direction. So fishteisach, I mean, where's the fish going to cough him up? The fish is going to cough him up onto the shores, you know, some country which, you know, is adjacent to the Mediterranean. I mean, he could have ended up in Spain, theoretically, right? But fortunately, he ended up back in Eretz Yisrael, because A, he had to get the Nevuah in Eretz Yisrael, right? B, you know, if he had to travel from Spain to Iraq, that would have been really, really quite a mahalach, you know? So, so you think about it, again, we don't think like that, because we don't think mm-hmm. of the geography when we, you know, after Yonah, you know, Yom Kippur afternoon, the last thing you're thinking about is geography, usually, right? You know,
I'd like to know, is Nineveh still exist now?
I don't. I think they know where it is. I don't think it's a city today in Iraq, but I mean, Nineveh was destroyed. Nineveh was destroyed. First of all, Sancheiriv made it, you know, his capital when the Nebuchadnezzar took over power. He came to Nineveh and conquered it, and then it was destroyed later on in history. I think they know where it is. You know, I think they have the ruins of Nineveh. I don't think it's currently a city, as far as I know. Could be wrong on that. I'm not sure. But Bekitzer, I mean, we do know where it was. You know, it was in Iraq, right? So again, you know, so he had to go back there to Israel anyway to get the Nevuah before he could go on to Nineveh, right? Bekasher nolad sheis b'dmus adam. When Shais is born to Adam, he's the replacement for Hevel, not just because, okay, I used to have two sons, and now I have two sons again. It's not just an arithmetic replacement for Hevel, but the same way that Hevel had that gene for godliness, Shais also had that gene for godliness, and that's what the pasuk says: "Kishosli Elokim zera acher tachas Hevel." I now have a replacement for Hevel, because now I have somebody who can carry on that tradition of the godly gene, which was lost when Cain killed Hevel. V'hoya roishi kari ben Adam ben Elokim ka Adam. Right, the Kuzari had explained before, back in the first essay, that the term in Chumash, Ben Elohim, son of God, refers to those human beings who carry this divine trait. Again, it doesn't mean that a son of God, certainly not Chalila in the Christian sense of the term, but in other words, they have this gene towards godliness, right? You know, so anyone who has a gene for godliness is called a Ben Elohim, right? So Adam was a Ben Elohim, Shais, Hevel was a Ben Elohim, and now Shais is also going to be a Ben Elohim. And therefore, Shais was zoche to this land, to Eretz Yisrael, which was, you know, just one step below Gan Eden. Now, again, he's understanding that Gan Eden was like the choicest part of Eretz Yisrael. So now he's zocha to the entire land, which maybe is not on the level of Gan Eden, but is the closest thing we have in our experience to the idea of Gan Eden. V'olel niskanu Yitzchak v'Yishmael. Right, the fight over Yitzchak and Yishmael is also about who's going to inherit Eretz Yisrael. V'nidcha Yishmael k'klipa. Yishmael was pushed aside. So even though God gave Yishmael a bracha that he would be blessed and would increase, but tova ha'olamis, that only refers to material good. Concerning Yitzchak, it says that the covenant is going to continue with Yitzchak, i.e. that connection to godliness and that connection to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Salomar, he davko b'inyan ha'eloki v'tova ba'olam haba. Right, the notion of clinging to God and the and you know goodness in Olam Haba is something which is going to be uniquely Yitzchak's. Ve'ein le'Yishmael bris v'lo le'Esav ve'imitzlichu. Despite the fact that both Yishmael and Esav did very well on a material level, right? You know, but neither of them had this bris, you know, to connect them to Eretz Yisrael. Ve'al an Eretz Hazos nafla hakina ben Yaakov ve'Esav bebechara o bebracha. Concerning Eretz Yisrael, that was the jealousy and the fight between Yaakov and Esav. Ad shenidcha Esav im cheskasa b'na Yaakov im choshasa. Right, that to the point where Esav, even with all of his strength, was pushed aside, you know, from Yaakov and his physical weakness, because Yaakov was the one who was destined, you know, to ultimately, inherit Eretz Yisrael. Unevuas Yirmiyah b'Mitzrayim bo b'avura. So going back to the original cases that he discussed, when Yirmiyahu HaNavi prophesied in Egypt, it was about going back to Eretz Yisrael. V'chein nevuas Moshe v'Aaron Miriam b'Paron, ki Sinai u'Paron migvul Eretz Kenan mipnei shehem min Yamsuf, k'mo she'omar yisborach v'shati yisgvucho, miyamsuf yad yom plishtim, u'mimidbar ar hanor, u'midbar u'midbar Paron, So when it comes to Moshe and Aaron and Miriam prophesizing outside of Eretz Yisrael, so you should know two things. He says, first of all, that their prophecies are all about Eretz Yisrael, right? And number two, because the truth is not all their prophecies are 100% about Eretz Yisrael. I mean, they're all indirectly about Eretz Yisrael, but let's say Miriam, according to Chazal, prophesies that Amram and Yocheved would have a son who would save the Jewish people. So I guess indirectly it's about Eretz Yisrael, because he'll save the Jewish people and take them out of Mitzrayim, and his successor, Yoshua, will take them into Eretz Yisrael. But you know, it's already a little... So he says basically, the places where Miriam and Aaron and Moshe prophesized, even if they weren't in Eretz Yisrael, they were adjacent to Eretz Yisrael. Very fascinating idea that he has. So in other words, if you're adjacent to Eretz Yisrael, it kind of works. You know, in other words, there's a difference between being in America and being, let's say, in Jordan. In Jordan, you have a shtickel of shaychus to Eretz Yisrael. You know, in Egypt, you have a little bit of a connection to Eretz Yisrael.
Mitzrayim is considered right, like in the gvul of Eretz Yisrael.
Right, so that's what he's saying. It's a very fascinating idea. In other words, so Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam prophesized because they were on the border.
Close.
They were close, right? V'anor, hu nahar piros gvul atzvoni. Right, the reference to the river, which is one of the borders of Eretz Yisrael, is the Nahar Piros, which is the northernmost border of Egypt up to Eretz Yisrael. Now Nahar Piros, which is he talks about here in the footnote. Nahar Piros oftentimes is the Euphrates, as we pointed out before. The Euphrates doesn't run anywhere near Eretz Yisrael. This was a smaller river called Nahar Piros that was on the southern border of Eretz Yisrael, closer to their border with Egypt. Right? So, but he's saying, in other words, in any case, Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe all prophesized in lands that were next to Eretz Yisrael, so that that gives that a certain yichus. We should point out, so where do you get this idea from? It sounds like a little bit of a cop-out, when you first read it. So the truth is it's rooted in halacha, because in halacha there are differences between lands outside of Eretz Yisrael versus lands that are smuchos le'Eretz Yisrael. Arosus ha-smuchos le'Eretz Yisrael, lands that are adjacent to Eretz Yisrael, are chayiv in many of the mitzvot hatluyos ba'aretz midrabbanan. They're so again, you know, for better or for worse, Jews generally don't live in those countries today. I mean, you know, Syria, Jordan, you know, I mean, these are not, you know, not too many people, you know, right, these are not places Jews want to live, generally speaking. But, you know, these countries have a certain halachic status. You know, they're chayiv in many, you know, if a person lives there, he's obligated to take off trumas and maisers, in many cases, midrabbanan. So in other words, it's not just, you know, it's not just Reb Yehuda Halevi coming along and saying, well, you know, close enough. No, I mean, you know, the lands that are close to Eretz Yisrael have a certain status in halacha, and that's probably what he's drawing on, you know, to come up with this particular idea.
So the midbar, the desert.
Right, so the desert, in other words, the desert, like the Sinai Peninsula, just south of Eretz Yisrael, right, so that's he's saying, that that has a certain... It's next to Eretz Yisrael.
You can see it realistically when you see the wars that are going on.
Yeah.
You know, that these are basically...
They can claim the quality of Eretz Yisrael.
Well, they have they're like grade B Eretz Yisrael, you know? In other words, it's not quite Eretz Yisrael, but for the purposes of a nevuah that has something to do with Eretz Yisrael, you know, so they can...
In the vicinity.
Yeah, they can slip by, you know, so to speak, says Reb Yehuda Halevi. Okay. Well, maybe stop here for tonight. We'll get everybody home before it snows too much. Next week, Be'ez Hashem, we'll speak about Purim issues.
Oh, yeah.
And probably after that, we'll probably already start talking about Pesach. You know, the other p-word. What's that?
So we don't.
Certainly not for next time, and then we'll see. You know, after that,
the next Monday
Shushan Purim. I don't know if that impacts on anybody's schedule. You know,
by Shushan Purim, we have a wedding.
Oh, okay, Mazel Tov.
You can't arrange your program with everybody.
Right.
You should arrange the wedding to be answered.
I'll bring the wedding here.
That's why we're only invited.
If it was up to them, we would be right here.
Not the Baba Bhatti. Right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
America is following.